And I was able to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to this lady. And you know, I never knew I was going to be able to do that. I never knew that God would take something and be able to make something so beautiful out of it. I never knew that. And about a month ago, I went back up there. Same attitude. Didn't want to go. Don't want to drive. It's going to be so late. It's going to be smoky. And I went up there, and I'm telling this story because it changed my mind, you know, my life. And I said, and it happened right there in that room. And he comes up after I got through talking. He says, Polly, her name's Marie. He says, she couldn't be here tonight. But I want you to know that she never fails to tell people that you were the one that carried the message to her. And she's still sober. So, you know, we all make a difference. If we're sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous, we make a difference. And how we behave as sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous is a responsibility. Because we never know. We may be the only big book anybody ever reads. It's a miracle. And we've got our grandson, Chris, and Kelly had to have a test when she was pregnant with Chris because she'd had a child with a birth defect. They found out that she was in the process of aborting the child she carried. So they did a cerclage on her and put her to bed for 5 months. And we have Chris. And you can't tell any of us, if it hadn't been because Ryan was deaf, we wouldn't have Chris. Because Kelly would have never had the test. And you know, the deal is that God has always performed these kind of miracles in my life. Always been performing miracles. But it's just been since sobriety that I've been able to see them. And I want to tell a little story, two little stories, and I'm going to sit down and let you get up and stretch your legs. I know you're dying. So Long said, you know, David died Monday before last, and I understand that David came here too, David Aronofsky, and he just didn't wake up Monday morning. And David used to say something that I love: the mind can only absorb as much as the butt can endure. So I'm going to be quick. I think it's so important how we behave, because you never know who's watching, and that it is a responsibility. To be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous is a responsibility, because how we behave is, because we're the attraction. We're the attraction that brings new people in. And it's like I said, I'm glad I don't act like I think. But David and I went to the subway. It was Katie's birthday, and we were going to have her one-year birthday, and we needed to drive way up to San Luis Obispo, but we were going to order the big, long subway sandwich for the party. So I'm in there, and these two gals are just yakking. And I'm just like on one foot and then the other, and I want to go, excuse me, you know, or some cute thing so that, you know, you have a customer here. And so I just kind of went from one foot to another, and finally she turned around, and she goes, oh, hi. And she comes running over here, and she's taking my order and all that, and she says, your name? And I said, Polly Pistol. And she goes, oh, my God, I heard you speak up at Woman to Woman. Now, wouldn't it have been wonderful if I had acted the way I thought? You just never know. I love this program, and I want this program just like it was when I got here 21 years ago. I don't think there's anything wrong with that book. I think it's gender perfect. I don't think there's anything wrong with the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want this program just like it was 14 and a half years ago when James got here, because I think Ryan's going to need you. And I want to tell you a little story about Ryan. We had to take Ryan to get some tests because we needed to find out the degree of his deafness. And they needed to put him to sleep. So they gave him the medication, and nothing happened. They gave him the medication again. Nothing happened. The third time, he finally went to sleep. And when he came to, he was doing this. That's more in sign language. Guard this program. As if your very life depends on it, because it does. Great events will come to pass. That's the great fact for us all. When I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, the best I could do was get myself pronounced dead on arrival. Thanks to this program, you've breathed life into me. And I wish that every day I had self-worth and self-confidence and all that stuff, but it doesn't come at 21. But there are a lot of days that I feel like I'm enough. And I definitely today am able to act like the woman I've always wanted to be. I've been able to be a faithful, true wife for almost 18 years. Dave and I will be married 18 years in October. For almost 18 years, I have been faithful and true to one man. And I didn't know I could do that. I've been self-supporting through my own contribution. For that, I'm truly grateful. And I never could do that. I got to talk to my ex-husband the other day, and he's very, very, very ill. And I just really feel bad because it looks like he's not going to live much longer, and I feel very bad for my boys. And you know, and I was just able to tell him, I said, you know, Roland, you lived with me for 22 years. You've had congestive heart failure, and now you have lung cancer. It just really doesn't seem fair. And, you know, you're just really a good man. And I just want to tell you how sorry I am that this is happening to you. And I'm just so grateful that we are able to do those things in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, that we're just able to mend relationships that most other places never get them mended, you know, Just the miracle, great events that come to pass. My sons told me a few years ago, Mom, you're the mom that we always wanted you to be. That's a great event that's come to pass. I talked to my son James yesterday, and James is in Chicago, and we talk nearly every day, and I have an 800 number, so that sort of helped. But James says, well, what are you up to this weekend? And I said, well, Dave and I are going to Salt Lake City, Utah to do our couples retreat. And James says, well, you tell all those people in Salt Lake that your son James loves you. That's a great event that's come to pass. God bless. I love you. So why don't we just close with the Lord's Prayer and take a stretch and go to the bathroom. Do the prayers, stretch, and all that good stuff. See if maybe you can get right in there. There we go. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory forever. Amen. Keep coming back. It works.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Dave Pistol, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Dave.
And I'm absolutely thrilled to be here. I get to see some old friends while I'm here that I've known for a long time that I love very much. And I was telling you about some of these guys last night, and you told me Leo was going to be here today, and he is. I told Leo I just hate it when somebody's in the audience that knows where I'm from, because I have to be honest, can't squeeze any little cute stuff in. We're going to start off today. We're going to try to accomplish several things. Alcoholics Anonymous is 63 years old, and as we all know, it got started by a New York Wall Street hustler, stockbroker, and an Akron proctologist. And I always think it's sort of fitting that one of the founders of Alcoholics Anonymous would be a proctologist. But I consider myself to be sort of the third generation of alcoholic. The first generation, of course, were Bill and Bob and the first 100 or so people that were involved in Alcoholics Anonymous and then helped really get it off the ground, and who really kept the faith when keeping the faith was not all that easy to do. And I, in my mind, the second generation are the people who knew Bill and Bob, and who are not necessarily contemporaries of theirs, but who knew them. And I consider myself sort of a third generation member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I came along and I knew the people who knew the people. And somehow we've managed to last for 63 years. And I look back and see a lot of other organizations and institutions back through history that just didn't last. They just didn't make it. And yet AA is alive and well and thriving. We're losing a lot of the people who are members of the second generation. A lot of you know David and Gracie, knew David and know Gracie Aronofsky. And I consider David to be a second generation member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I considered Albert Myers to be a sort of a second generation member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He was a very dear friend of mine. Both of those guys were. David Aronofsky was sitting there in a meeting in the Preston Group in Dallas, Texas when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. He was already there. And he was teaching people like me and Polly when we first came in. He was already behind podiums teaching people about the steps and particularly the traditions. And those people are just simply going through the natural course of life. You know, we're all born and we grow up and we grow old and we die. And that's the natural course of life. And we're beginning to lose a lot of very significant second generation people. And what that means is that the torch is being passed. Yet again, it was passed from the first generation to the second, and now it's in the process of being passed from the second to the third. And it becomes ever more important for us to realize where we came from and what we're about, because we got to keep this thing alive, because your kids and your grandkids are going to need it. The world is not getting to be an easier, friendlier place to live in. It's getting, you know, from my perspective, it's getting to be just the opposite. It's, you know, we live in an era now, we were talking about this at breakfast, we live in an era now where everybody has rights and nobody has any obligations. And if you don't believe that, just do something somebody doesn't like and they'll be coming at you brandishing their attorney. And so I think the need for Alcoholics Anonymous is certainly not going to diminish. And if we're going to keep Alcoholics Anonymous alive and well for our children and our grandchildren, then we have to step up to the plate and assume responsibility. I know that sounds pretty serious for Saturday morning, and the whole day's not going to be along that same serious line, but it is nevertheless true. You know, we have to do what we can to make sure that Alcoholics Anonymous stays lively and viable and an attractive place for drunks to come and get well. So with that in mind, here's what we're going to do today. First thing we're going to do is I'm going to read a prayer. And I'll tell you about this prayer in a minute, but I'm going to read that. And then we're going to cover a few characteristics of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm going to pose three questions to you. And then we're going to do kind of a brief history of alcoholism and things that have happened in the area, general area of alcoholism, starting with the book of Proverbs about 3,000 years ago. And then we're going to kind of read the traditions. And then we're going to, Polly and I are going to go through and tell you how we have used going to those second generation people that we know and love, how we have learned to use the traditions in our marriage. And I'll tell you, I'll make a flat statement right up front. And you can beat me up at the break if you don't like it. And that is that I don't know of anybody that has a better marriage than I do. I know people that have a marriage as good as mine, but I don't know anybody that has a better one than I do. And when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I did not have the faintest idea how to have a relationship with another human being on any level, and had none going with another human being on any level. So I came here knowing absolutely nothing, and everything I know about being a 50% of a happy, thriving marriage, I learned from you. I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I learned that most of it comes right out of the ideas and the concepts and the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, it's my opinion, and unless I'm reading out of this, what you're hearing is my opinion. Just remember, it may be worth what it costs you. But it's my opinion that the traditions are much more important than steps. Because, you know, if I don't work the steps, I'm going to get drunk. It's pretty complicated. You know, most of you in this room have been sober for a while, and I'm not likely to get a quarrel on that. If I don't work the steps, I'm probably going to get drunk. If I don't work the steps, I'm not going to have a personality change. I'm going to keep the personality of a practicing alcoholic, and I'll go drink again. It's just the way it works. However, if we don't observe the traditions, we're going to lose AA, and we're all going to get drunk. Because it ain't easy getting to be 63 years old when you have a mixture of people like us. You know, it is not easy. You know, because we all have the attitude, generally speaking, well, why don't we be reasonable and do it my way? Most of us are willing to die for our way. And it is the traditions that allows us to keep together and stay together and love each other and have a good time and enjoy each other's company and do things like this and be happy and sober and free. So that's one of the reasons I want to talk about them today and how they affect our lives, me and Polly. I have a prayer I want to start off with, and this is a prayer that was, you know, sometimes things happen to you. You're just cruising along, and you know, and it's a normal day, and all of a sudden somebody does or says something and just really yanks your head around, and you just know that something has just really touched you that's significant. And that's the way it was with this prayer. Polly and I were at the 13th annual Orange County AA conference, and. And the person that was leading the Saturday night meeting got up and said, Father John M. is now going to open the meeting with a blessing. And Father John M. got up, and he unfolded this thing out of his breast pocket, and laid it on the podium. And he read this, and it's something that he had written. And it was one of those things that just really touched me. And I went up and talked to Father John M. after that and told him how much I was touched by his prayer. And he gave me a copy of it, and I have it, and I will be glad to, I'm not only going to read it, but if any of you would like a copy of it, I'll leave my copy with you, and you can arrange to have somebody make copies and keep it locally. So don't hesitate to ask if this happens to touch you like it did me. And the name of his prayer is Gracias. Let us pray. God, I know you aren't necessarily impressed and certainly not fooled by my appearance here, but let me invoke you now to remember why I go to AA meetings. I address you. Power of breathing, power of life, my higher power, heart of my heart, you have done remarkable things. New, astonishing deeds of power, and yet so much is left undone. Let me breathe this bit of unfinished freedom before I begin my appeal. For breath and heartbeat, a place to stand, and language to complain. Thank you. Now that I am breathing in and out, should I simply stand here till you come? How long should I await your always late arrival? My family's not perfected, utopia's betrayed, and still I should thank you? For making me wait to worry and wonder why so much is yet undone. Ossie says, if you pray, don't worry. And if you worry, don't pray. No sense trying to do both. I know I am unknown, and you simply are. Everywhere you are known in the wonder of these gatherings of brothers and sisters of the Spirit. In our meetings, you have promised to make us known to ourselves. Perhaps that's why I stay away sometimes. Or learn to report on how I've handled the near past, where you aren't, instead of the near flammable present, where you are. Where breathing and standing interrupt my thinking and clear a space in the unkempt warehouse of my soul. I wonder if you'll set me to fire again. I'm afraid you won't. But then the blessing is invoked when we call our names and ritually identify the soul sickness and know a new thanksgiving. I'm pulled again beyond my thoughts to live in this moment of undeserved, unearned grace. Gracias, grace. Gracias for undeserved grace. Gracias por tus dones, Gracias por mi vida, mi amor, Dios de mi corazón. Amén. Okay. Let's talk about, for a minute, some characteristics of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think the best thing about Alcoholics Anonymous, one of the best things, is that we are an inclusive organization. We are not exclusive. We have a sign that you see around a lot of AA gatherings that says, whenever anyone, anywhere, I mean, that's pretty broad, anyone, anywhere, reaches out for help, I want the hand of AA to be there always. Always is pretty broad. And it goes on to say, and for that, I am responsible. So we are an inclusive organization, not exclusive. All alcoholics are welcome as members of AA, and anybody else walking around on the planet is welcome at open meetings of AA. We're wide open. And it's not just okay with us that you're here. If you're new, we want you here. You'd be surprised where we go looking for you. Lord Almighty. I mean, we go to jails and drunk farms, and you know, we have panels that go trolling in some of the wildest places. I had a guy, he took a panel in all the time to the mentally disturbed sex offender unit in Tascadero State Penitentiary in California. And we'd go there, and let me tell you, when the cold steel door clanks shut when you're walking in that place, it'll cause your sphincter to oscillate. And so we want you here. We turn over rocks. We do everything looking for you and doing our best to attract you. And we want you to be here. We are an inclusive organization. In fact, you're even welcome here. You know, if you have to come here drinking, you're even welcome coming here drinking. This is Alcoholics Anonymous, after all. This is a, you know, this is not some little religious or other kind of organization where you have to meet certain qualifications before you can come. If drinking is the only way you can get here, come drinking. Some of us had to. I certainly didn't come sober to my first few AA meetings. I would have if I could, you know, but you either take me drinking or you don't get me. We'll take you drinking. We don't demand anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. Our steps of recovery are suggested. Our book says, here are the steps which are suggested as a program of recovery. Now, there are people like me who have opinions that there are suggestions and there are suggestions. If you've ever had a cop suggest that you quietly sit down in the back seat of his squad car, that's a suggestion. You don't have to take it. But our steps are suggested. We don't demand anything. You know, you are free as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous to totally ignore everything in the book and every recommendation or suggestion we give you without forfeiting your membership. We don't recommend that. It's probably not going to work out too well for you. But if you want to do that, you can. Because you're a member of AA if you say you are. And then, so we don't demand that you do anything. In addition to that, you know, we don't have anybody in charge here. How'd you like to be an attorney and try to sue AA? You know, you come in and say, well, who's in charge? Nobody. Who do I serve these papers on? Doesn't matter. Anybody you want to. The third characteristic is that AA is essentially free. We don't have any money, and we don't have any property. And that's a good thing for us, because if we had it, we'd just fight over who's going to control it. You know? I mean, the reason we don't have any problems with money or property is because we don't have any. You know, what we take up in our meetings, we give away at the end of the month, usually, or some scenario along that line. Anytime we have any money left over, we give it away to central office, to some other area of Alcoholics Anonymous that needs the money. There's a lot of people that like to go around and pound on the podium about, for example, all the money that New York has, and they don't need all that money, and what do they do with all that stuff, and so forth. And perhaps you don't know, perhaps you do, but the New York office, for example, is run by a committee of people called the General Service Board. Seven of the members of that board are not even alcoholics. They are accomplished businessmen and doctors and other guys that have been down the trail, and there are 14 Class B delegates who are alcoholics, and they decide what our prudent reserve should be, and AA keeps what they think is about a one-year prudent reserve. Because, see, we don't have any bills. We don't owe anybody anything. We don't own anything. If you back your truck up to AA office and unload it, they write you a check for what you just delivered. We're net 30 on everything. We don't owe any money. So even as an organization at the highest level, we don't accumulate any property or any money or anything. We're just free. And we have some very clear guidelines on clubs and the relationships between clubs and groups. And that's long been a subject that's put to rest. In addition to routine alcoholics, another characteristic is that we have a wide variety of people in here. We have neurotics, a lot of neurotics. Boy, we are just up to here. Neurotics. We have a lot of psychotics that wander in. Some of whom have even been helped by AA. We have a lot of sociopaths that come here. A lot of thieves, liars, and cheats. They're the bread and butter of AA. And most of us are thieves, liars, and cheats by our own admission, so it's not like I'm giving away some big secret here. We have a lot of bleeding leak deacons that will sit back there and bleed all over the place at the drop of a hat, you know. Well, when I went to meetings in Rock Springs, they didn't do it this way. We have some traditions lawyers that are willing to, who are absolutely convinced that they know exactly what the traditions and every other aspect of AA is all about, and they are convinced that they represent the true spirit of Alcoholics Anonymous. They believe that to their core, and that and they're willing to die for their way. There's a lot of us that have an astonishing willingness to practice medicine and law and psychotherapy and a lot of other professions, and despite our complete lack of credentials of any kind to do that, you know, we don't have any medical degrees or any law degrees or anything, but that never slows us down, boy. And that's both funny and sad. I don't know if David talked about this or not, but David, when he talked about the traditions, he talked about a lady in their group. And this lady had suffered some pretty severe brain trauma. And in order to avoid convulsions, to prevent convulsions, she had to take a couple of drugs. One of them was phenobarbital. And one night, they were sitting around, and this lady had been a really bad alcoholic, and she came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and she got sober. And as a result of getting sober and being a member in good standing, of really keeping the faith with Alcoholics Anonymous, she was able to become self-supporting through her own contributions. They helped her find a job. She had a place to live on her own, and she was just thriving, just doing well. And one night, sitting around the Preston Club after a meeting, a couple of well-meaning people. See, that's always the problem. Nobody's out to get you. When it happens to you, it's usually done through well-meaning people. But a couple of well-meaning people, one of them had a couple of years, the other one had around 5 years, told her that if she was taking phenobarbital, she wasn't sober. And you know what's coming, don't you? She wanted to be sober more than anything. And because of that, she quit taking it. And shortly thereafter, she had a seizure and she died. And they asked those two guys to be pallbearers at her funeral. But, you know, sometimes it's funny to see a self-appointed traditions lawyer get up and huff and puff and about how you're not doing it right. That usually means you're not doing it his way or her way. But sometimes it has pretty tragic results. Bill Wilson's family reunion down in San Diego, and before that in Seattle and Montreal and New Orleans and Denver. Anybody get to that? You know, that was absolutely a marvelous, marvelous thing. We had people from all over the world. We had all kinds of mixed cultures. We had all kinds of mixed ethnicity, different people with different dress, different habits, different ways of doing things, laughing and smiling, helping cops direct traffic, just having a wonderful time. You know, and if you had on one of those big blue badges, that was an automatic invitation to hug anybody else that had one of those big badges. I mean, if you have been to any one of those, you can't imagine the warmth and the love you feel in a stadium that has 55,000 alcoholics in it, doing the wave, laughing, and just having a really good time loving each other. And you have to know, and I know you do, that's not an accident. Those things don't happen by accident. No, those are the results of the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, saying no matter where you come from, or how you dress, or how you talk, or anything else, you know, we love you, and we know you love us. So, those are some aspects, some characteristics of Alcoholics Anonymous that make me really proud to be a member. I don't know of any organization anywhere on this planet that I would rather be a member of than AA. You know, and it's just, I know that sounds a little extravagant, but it's really true. And I suspect it's true for a lot of people in this room, you know. I mean, this is where the rubber meets the road. This is where you learn how to live. So let me ask you, let me pose these three questions that I mentioned. First of all, do you think the idea that alcoholism is a disease originated with AA or with that now famous American Medical Association letter written in 1959 in which they went on record and said they believe alcoholism is an illness? So that's question number one. Number two is, do you think Alcoholics Anonymous is the first organization or group that has effectively dealt with the disease of alcoholism? Number three is, why have we been able to last? Even thrive, not just last. We're thriving. Didn't need to. I didn't bring my my Bible with me. They look at you funny when you walk around the halls with a Gideon Bible. But if you go, if you're curious about this, you go look in the book of Proverbs, and I think it's either chapter 23, verse 29, which is what I think it is, or it's chapter 29, verse 23. I'm pretty sure it's chapter 23, verse 29. Anyway, Proverbs was written as a book in the Old Testament. It was written mostly by a guy named Solomon about 3,000 years ago, and in this little few verses in there, Solomon very eloquently describes the disease of alcoholism. He talks about wine and strong spirits and fortified spirits, and that in the end it stings like an adder. He talks about like a sailor being on top of a mast when you're drunk. You know, everybody's been in the spinning room. And then he talks about waking up, finding out somebody beat the hell out of you last night. You don't even remember who did it or that it was even done. And that it says, yet he will arise and seek it yet again. And you know, and the verse starts off, who has woe, who has sorrow, those that tarry long at the wine. So alcoholism is not exactly a new thing. It's been around for a while. And I think, you know, from the time Solomon wrote that until the mid-1930s, people like you and I didn't have much of a chance. We just didn't. We did what alcoholics did up until that time. We just slowly died from the disease of alcoholism. There was a guy in 1796 wrote a paper. It was a guy named Benjamin Rush. He was an interesting guy. Benjamin was a doctor, and he was born in 1813 in Philadelphia, and he came from a good family. And he was raised and educated in Philadelphia, in that area. And he got an undergraduate degree, went to Europe to study. And he worked with what was then a very famous physician over in Europe, a guy by the name of William Cullen. And he got his medical degree over there. And he came back to the U.S. and got involved in politics. He liked to write, and he liked to get involved in politics. And he became sort of like the Surgeon General to the Continental Army, when the War of Independence broke out, and he sounded a little bit like an alcoholic, although he didn't. I don't guess that he was, because he didn't like the way some of the other people were doing. He didn't like the way one of the other. He was the Surgeon General of his local army, and there was another Surgeon General of the whole Continental Army. He didn't like the way that guy was doing his job, so he wrote to George on later, but he wrote and said that, you know, this guy's a bum, we got to get rid of him, and instead they got rid of him. And then later on he didn't like George, and he thought we ought to get rid of George as a president, so he wrote to somebody about that. And finally, he just had to get out of politics. But he wrote a paper in 1796. He got kind of weird. He developed some ideas about medicine. He thought what he called depletion was a really good idea, which is bleeding people. And when people, there was a big yellow fever epidemic that swept through, and he's around bleeding everybody, and they were dying like flies. And so he... had a little trouble proving his ideas. Anyway, he had a occasion to write a paper in 1796, and the name of it is An Inquiry. And the thing is, I want to read some of it, a little of it to you. And the reason I want to read it is because you need to hear his language. I mean, it's just beautiful the way he puts some of this stuff. And it's just absolutely great. It's really funny. Some of this is really funny. And this is a paper about fermented versus ardent spirits. And ardent spirits are those liquors which only are obtained by distillation. And so he's of the opinion that fermented liquors contain so little spirit that so intimately combined with other matters, they can seldom be drunken in sufficient quantities to produce intoxication. See, if it were true that beer wouldn't get you drunk, how many of us wouldn't be here? And he says that it's difficult to be drunken in sufficient quantities to produce intoxication and its subsequent effects without exciting a disrelish to their taste. Never tasted that bad to me, or from distending the stomach. They are, moreover, when taken in a moderate quantity, generally innocent and often have a friendly influence on health and life. I mean, isn't that what we all wanted? But then he goes on to talk about the effects of ardent spirits. And he says, I shall begin by briefly describing their prompt or immediate effects in a fit of drunkenness. And then here's the sentence. This odious disease, for by that name it should be called. So even guys like old Benjamin Rush back in 1796 were calling alcoholism a disease.
They didn't even have a term alcoholism yet. But drunkenness was referred to as an odious disease. Anyway, he says that this odious disease appears with more or less of the following symptoms, and most commonly in the order in which I shall enumerate them. 1, unusual garrulity. 2 is unusual silence. 3, captiousness and a disposition to quarrel. 4, uncommon good humor and an insipid simpering or laugh. 5, profane swearing or cursing. A disclosure of their own or other people's secrets. He had a snail, didn't he? A rude disposition to tell those persons in company whom they know their faults. Certain immodest actions. I am sorry to say this sign of the first stage of drunkenness sometimes appears in women who when sober are uniformly remarkable for chaste and decent manners. Number 9 is a clipping of words. Number 10 is fighting. A black eye or a swell nose often mark this grade of drunkenness. Number 11, certain extravagant acts which indicate a temporary fit of madness. These are singing, hallooing, roaring, imitating the noises of brute animals, jumping, tearing off clothes, dancing naked, breaking glasses and china, and dashing other articles of household furniture upon the ground or floor. Guilty. After a while, the paroxysm of drunkenness is completely formed. The face now becomes flushed. The eyes project and are somewhat watery. Winking is less frequent than is natural. The underlip is protruded. The head inclines a little to one shoulder. The jaw falls. Belchings and hiccups take place. The limbs totter. The whole body staggers. The unfortunate subject of this history next falls on his seat. He looks around him with a vacant countenance and mutters inarticulate sounds to himself. He attempts to rise and walk. In this attempt, he falls upon his side, from which he gradually turns upon his back. He now closes his eyes and falls into a profound sleep, frequently attended with snoring and profuse sweats, and sometimes with such a relaxation of the muscles which confine the bladder and the lower bowels as to produce a symptom which delicacy forbids me to mention. In this condition, he often lies from 10, 12, and 24 hours to 2, 3, 4, and 5 days, an object of pity and disgust to his family and friends. His recovery from this fit of intoxication is marked with several peculiar appearances. He opens his eyes and closes them again. He gapes and stretches his limbs. He then coughs and pukes. His voice is hoarse. He rises with difficulty and staggers to a chair. His eyes resemble balls of fire. His hands tremble. He loathes the sight of food. He calls for a glass of spirits to compose his stomach. Now and then he emits a deep, far-fetched sigh or groan from a transient twinge of conscience, but he more frequently scolds and curses everything around him. So, these are the writings of Dr. Rush back in 1796, talking about the disease of alcoholism. He says that, goes on to say that the following diseases are the usual consequences of the habitual use of ardent spirits. 1 is a decay of appetite. 2 is obstructions of the liver. 3 is jaundice and dropsy of the belly and limbs, and finally of every cavity in the body. 4 is hoarseness and a husky cough. 5 is diabetes. This is a frequent and weakening discharge of pale or sweetish urine. 6 is redness and eruptions on different parts of the body. I mean, these are things that we all have seen or have experienced. A fetid breath composed of everything that is offensive. Frequent and disgusting belchings. Epilepsy, gout in all its various forms of swell limbs. And lastly, madness. The late Dr. Waters, while he acted as house pupil and apothecary of the Pennsylvania Hospital, assured me that in 1/3 of the patients confined by this terrible disease, it had been induced by ardent spirits. And in another place down here, he says, even the hair of the head possesses a crispness which renders it less valuable to wig makers than the hair of sober people. So, you know, it's a lot of drawbacks to being an alcoholic. Thus we see poverty and misery, crimes and infamy, diseases and death are all the natural and usual consequences of the intemperate use of ardent spirits. I've classed death among the consequences of hard drinking, but it is not death from the immediate hand of the deity, nor from any of the instruments of it which were created by him. It is death by suicide. Wonder no longer that the sun should shine and the rain fall and the grass look green upon his grave. He had some suggestions as to what you could do. You know, remember that he is trying to differentiate between hard liquor and fermented liquor, like beer and so forth. So he says, you know, one of the substitutes you can use is just simple water. Well, come on. Please. Please. Cider. He says, cider's good. This excellent liquor contains a small quantity of spirit, but so diluted and blunted by being combined with a large quantity of saccharine matter and water as to be perfectly wholesome. Sounds good to me. Drink cider. Malt liquors. The grain from which these liquors are obtained is not liable, like the apple, to be affected by frost, and therefore can be procured at all times and at a moderate price. They contain a good deal of nourishment, since we find many of the poor people in Great Britain endure hard labor with no other food than a quart or 3 pints of beer with a few pounds of bread a day. So, see, beer is nourishing. You can go out there and drink a few pints of beer and some little bread, and you work hard all day long. Wines are good. These fermented liquors are composed of the same ingredients as cider and are both cordial and nourishing. The peasants of France who drink them in large quantities are a sober and healthy body of people. So at any rate, to the question, you know, do you think that alcoholism as a disease originated with AA? Not at all. Now, there were people like this, as misguided as this poor guy was, you know, he was as informed as he could get in his day and age. And the work of Dr. Rush, from this tract that he wrote, there arose from that sort of a following, and it generally they began to evolve a temperance movement in this country. And I know you've all heard about the Women's Christian Temperance Union and things like that. They got a temperance thing started, and the reason for that they got for temperance, if you always wondered why it was a temperance society rather than an abstinence society, it's because of several ideas that came about. One is that there is a line you cross over from becoming just a normal person who drinks fermented or alcoholic beverages normally, to an alcoholic. And once you cross the line and become an alcoholic, it's over. So because they used a lot of booze in ecclesiastical events, they couldn't get the backing of the church to believe this, to become an abstinence society. The church wouldn't hear of it. The church people like to get together and drink. And so they had to be an abstinence society, and their plan was to prevent people from becoming alcoholics. Drink all the beer, wine, whatever you wanted, but don't drink ardent spirits because you'll become an alcoholic. And once you cross over and become an alcoholic, it's too late. You're done. You're done for, and there's nothing that anybody can do for you. So this all kind of got started in a general temperance movement, and that was doing pretty good for the first part of the century. There's a guy named Lyman Beecher that got into a lot of this and got it started and was a spokesman for a while, and he was really very fond of Dr. Rush's work. And and then in 1840, they were having some temperance people go around the country and give lectures and so forth. And there was six old drunks that liked to sit around Chase's Tavern in Baltimore every day and drink. And they were just garden variety drunks. There was a couple of blacksmiths and a silversmith and a carriage maker. And they heard the temperance lecture. And they decided, well, you know, in the spirit of fun, maybe we should send a delegation to this temperance lecture, and the delegates could then come back and report to us on what happened. So that seemed like a good idea. So they sent these. So four of them went as a delegation, and they came back, and they decided that they ought to start some kind of movement of their own, but they ought to really go for abstinence and not temperance. And so they decided that's what they were going to do. So we wound up getting a group of guys together from this tavern, and they were they wrote a pledge. I got to read you their pledge. The pledge was: we whose names are annexed, desirous of forming a society for our mutual benefit and to guard against a pernicious practice which is injurious to our health, standing, and families, do pledge ourselves as gentlemen that we will not drink any spirituous or malt liquors, wine, or cider. So they wrote this pledge. And so what happened is they decided they were going to get together once a week. And they were going, and the deal was that when you come to our meetings, you try to bring another man with you. And we're going to get organized here. They decided that the initiation fee was going to be 25 cents, and that the monthly dues were going to be 12 and a half cents, or 2 bits and 1 bit a month. And so they just got going, and they're having this meeting, and they're continuing to have it every week in Chase's Tavern, because that's where they always hung out. Well, Mrs. Chase is getting tired of this. All her good drinking patrons are joining this bunch of clowns over here in the corner. Nobody's drinking anymore. So she got a broom and ran them off. So, you know, go have your dumb meeting somewhere else. You're not coming in my tavern and sober up all my customers. So they got run out of there, and they went down and rented a hall. And it was a very nice hall. And they were doing pretty good. So as they grew in membership, they faced the problem of making their weekly meetings interesting. And here's where it gets interesting for us. Their resourceful president made the suggestion that each member relate his own experience. He started off with his own story of 15 years of excessive drinking, adding his reactions to his newly gained freedom. Others followed suit. Isn't that great? One alcoholic sharing their experience, strength, and hope with another. And this was 1840 in Baltimore. They found out something else. They first were going to name their organization after Thomas Jefferson, and they decided no, they didn't like that. And they named it after George Washington, and they called themselves the Washingtonians. And they did really well. They began to grow rather significantly, as a matter of fact. It says, these men spared neither their money nor their time in carrying out the principles which they had espoused. Many a poor fellow who from the effect of liquor had become a burden to his family and himself was fed and clothed by them and won by kindness to reform his life. Even more than this, they have supported the families of those whom they had induced to join with them until the husband and father had procured work and was enabled to support them with his own hands. Until then, until this group of guys got together and did this, if you were a drunkard, you were an outcast, you were a pariah, you were treated with scorn, even with hatred, and the Washingtonians said drunks need to be treated kindly and with respect. They need to have to be loved and to be nurtured while we try to help them get over their problem. Scorn and ridicule accomplish nothing. And so they grew. Over here, it also says about a guy who was talking, Monday I wanted to go down and see my old associates who had joined the Washingtonian Society. I went and signed. I felt like a free man. What was I now to do to regain my character? My friends took me by the hand. They encouraged me. They did right. If there is a man on earth who deserves the sympathy of the world, it is the poor drunkard. He is poisoned, degraded, cast out, knows not what to do, and must be helped or be lost. And these guys were just unbelievable. When the standing room in the hall was filled a few evenings later and the crowd responded with unrestrained enthusiasm, several hundred coming forward to sign the pledge at the close of the meeting, there was no longer any doubt that the Washingtonian reformers had a universally potent appeal. Here was human interest par excellence. No fiction could be more exciting or dramatic. These true life narratives pulled at the heartstrings. They aroused awe and wonder at the miracle of rebirth. This was written in the Boston Mercantile Journal back in the mid-18th century. Formal religious beliefs had flesh and blood put on dry bones. And to the victim of drink, the Washingtonian message was like a promise of life to a doomed man. It was the impossible come true. These guys were really doing well. They had they thrived to the point where when they were a few years old, they had thousands of chapters all over the country. The country wasn't all that big in the mid-1800s, but they had them all over the country, all over the eastern seaboard, I should say. And they were so well thought of and so respected that Abraham Lincoln addressed one of their gatherings. And so they did really well. Another thing that they started that I'll mention on the way by is that they got an organization going, an organization of women that they called the Martha Washington Societies. And it was sort of like a first run at Al-Anon as we know it today. It was to help wives and also to help female alcoholics. So it wasn't exactly, you know, sober significant others or sober families, but it was a sort of an auxiliary to the main program. And so even then, you know, it was noticed that in other words, their pledge talked about the families of alcoholics and how the whole family needed help. So we, the undersigned ladies of the city of New York, feeling ourselves especially called upon not only to refrain from the use of all intoxicating drinks, but by our influence and example to induce others to do the same thing.